Question for Solomon. I'm thinking of the Leonardo da Vinci, the programmable Leonardo da Vinci effect in Stone Age time and at the gather time, there will be people who might be full of the same point and invented agriculture, but the opportunity cost was such that it was moving to get out. Until, and this was the point that I thought was missing in your speech, if you elaborate on that, until a point had been reached that nobody could expand any further to other hunter-gathering grounds that had not previously been occupied by other tribes. Same could happen then later. Other inventions that just not the right time because opportunity costs were still too great. And Leonardo da Vinci invented the aerospace, nonetheless, people didn't want to pay costs. But before people wanted to need that, they needed other things first to be invented. So could you elaborate on that?
I'm not quite sure if I understood what you're driving at. The main point that I tried to make is simply that that average standards of living did not rise for thousands of years. For that, there does exist in the meantime overwhelming evidence. I think one of the most important books that makes this point is by Gregory Clark, Farewell to Arms, who demonstrates, I think quite convincingly, that you can go back to the very first records that we have of wages being paid and prices for various goods to come to the conclusion that standards of living in Babylonia were not all that much different from what you find in 1600, 1700, 1800 England. And then how do we explain the fact that it took such an enormous amount of time to gradually strip ourselves out of this predicament? Another important thing is the Industrial Revolution did not take place at one specific point in time. It is something that occurred in the course of maybe 200 years. You could gradually see that mankind improved in this regard, so that there's some sort of threshold must have been reached. And that economic theory is in and of itself not able to explain the lengths of this process. I think there's nothing wrong with economic theory not explaining this, so to speak. As I emphasized, I'm of course a strong believer that the tools that economic theory offers us in explaining what is required in order to grow are absolutely correct. Nonetheless, the length of time that it required is inexplicable, so to speak, unless we find some other mechanism that explains this. And this other mechanism is, in the course of thousands of years, a different kind of man evolved. And how that happened, the mechanism is economic success is translated into reproductive success. So some of these detailed questions were so when was opportunity cost for this too high or too low and so forth. I'm not trying to answer these types of questions. I have a far more fundamental question. How can we understand the long-run course of human economic history without recognizing that something like an ongoing biological evolutionary process must have been going on. And once we recognize that, then many phenomena that we know of do make more sense than if we simply ignore this ongoing biological evolutionary process.
I'd like to go and ask Dr. Gavin a question. First of all, thank you for your excellent speech. You painted a very necessary complex picture of what constitutes a ruling class. I was wondering if you thought we could develop some kind of targeting or labeling methodology to stick the labels of these people so the entire population can see what they are, so that we can more easily grab them and destroy them. Or do you think we should just concentrate on mining their ideologies as they develop them?
Well, the answer is both. We must, of course, continue to attack their legitimizing ideologies. And there are many libertarians and conservatives who are doing a very good job of that. When it comes to labeling members of the ruling class, it is necessarily rather difficult because these people are not totally parasitic. Sometimes they do act within the productive economy, and sometimes they act outside the productive economy. The English radicals of the early 19th century had a distinction between tax eaters and tax payers. And it seems a fairly clear-cut distinction until you look at it in the modern context. You see, I occasionally work as a university lecturer. I'm paid by the state. To that extent, I'm a tax eater. I'm also a tax payer. Now, I suppose if I look at my tax return, I can say that on balance, I'm a tax payer. But I'm sure that I receive many other benefits from the state that I don't take into account. It is very difficult to say in most regards whether somebody is a tax eater or a tax payer. And when you look at the wicked Polly Toynbee, for those of you who don't know her, she is a particularly nauseous left-wing journalist who writes for The Guardian. I'm not sure that she gets a penny from the taxpayer. It all comes from The Guardian. But, of course, The Guardian gets a lot of its revenue from running all those advertisements for AIDS outreach coordinators and walking advisors and parking studies lecturers. But it is difficult to pin a label on someone and say, you are a member of the ruling class, therefore I want to smash you. I wish we could do it, and in some cases we can, but it's not as easy as it seems.
May I add something to this? This is, of course, one of the great advantages of the Marxists, that they could pinpoint who is member of the ruling class and who isn't. He who owns the means of production is, and he who doesn't isn't. With this concept of tax eaters and tax payers, the libertarians try to accomplish the same sort of simplicity. You might be able to figure out who is a tax payer and who is a tax eater. Nonetheless, this is not a very good concept in order to determine who is member of the ruling class, because clearly you would not consider welfare recipients a member of the ruling class. You would not consider a plumber working for the state be a member of the ruling class. On the other hand, we have, of course, many people who work entirely outside of the domain of the state, who clearly are members of the ruling class, leading businessmen who can accomplish, for instance, that legislation is passed that benefits them at the expense of their competitors. Nonetheless, in terms of this tax eater, taxpayer dichotomy, they would have to be labeled as people who are outside of the ruling class. And this was one of the reasons why I asked Sean to just present some thoughts on this difficulty that we have. And I do not know how we can overcome it and come up with a clear-cut statement. This guy is an evil guy, so he has to be smashed, and this one is not. We have to just look at every individual case. That makes our case more difficult, I admit, but that's the way it is.
Yeah. question for Professor Cobbler. As you probably are aware, there is a creative plan kind of hunter-gatherer age until there was no more people working hunter and gathering, and then to settle down to agriculture, which was limited by the conclusion of trap, which we suppressed some years ago. Is this current age also has some kind of trap, the European one, whereas the unlimited growth state is the one that stops us from achieving new heights or new states of development?
And I must admit that I'm not quite sure if I got the drift of the question. Hunter and gatherers were under Malthusian conditions again and again and again. It was not only until the point came when absolutely no land was available anymore. It happened hundreds of thousands of times at various locations that Malthusian conditions arose. Why did nobody ever invent agriculture and animal husbandry as a way out of it? And instead, it was always people migrating to different places. That, again, we cannot explain unless we have another explanatory dimension, that is a growth of intelligence. So it's not only that the pressure, so to speak, to invent a solution to the Malthusian trap only arises once the entire globe is settled by hunters and gatherers, but it has happened, of course, before the entire globe was settled by hunters and gatherers, thousands and thousands of times before. And every time a decision had to be made, hunters and gatherers, from what we know, worked 3 or 4 hours per day. So they had plenty of time to think of anything they wanted, but they didn't. Again, I'm not quite sure if I answered your question, but even if I didn't, I hope it still made some sense of what I said apart from that.
Another question to Hans Hoppe. It is, how does the libertarian deal with the problem of distinctions? And if I could elaborate the question, at the end of your talk, you alluded to the fact that we the economic third world, moved into a stage of distinct fertility over the last century or so. Let's say a stage in which people, the more intelligent people, are having fewer children than the less intelligent people. People with low time references, desirable personality qualities of self constraints or control or idleness and so forth, if people are having fewer children, having people who lack these qualities. And this is a real problem, I think. This implies that genetic quality of the populations in the developed world is deteriorating in respect of these important qualities. And this is definitely an important problem. We can envisage that an authoritarian state could deal with this problem. Indeed, a blueprint of this kind was set out by Plato. The solution is to breed from the more desirable people with a more desirable genetic qualities, and that may be enforced by the state. And it is hardly possible to envisage that an authoritarian state, such as, for example, contemporary China, might put such a policy into effect, but only require minor modifications of the one-child policy. But it is a difficult problem, I think, for the libertarian.
Okay. I mean, two parts of the answer. The first one is simply we have to see the facts as they are. This is just a positive statement. Is it really the case that there were eugenic effects at work before and dysgenic effects are at work right now. I think many libertarians are entirely blind to the fact that that these facts exist. I'm rather convinced that the facts do exist. The second question is, what are we about to do it? What can we do about it? And there, the libertarian answer would be, of course, the state has to be eliminated as far as possible. Welfare state policies have to be eliminated as much as possible. And then it is, of course, up to each individual household, so to speak, to balance the number of people that they themselves breed with the resources that they are capable of producing, and then let the market do its work.
If I could make a comment on that, which amounts to a question to Hans, I must say that your explanation of the Industrial Revolution is the first entirely convincing explanation I've seen. All of the others appear to leave something out, whereas what yours does is to explain in a very satisfactory way why it happened when it happened. However, what you're describing may not be an upward swing. It may be a very, very long cycle, and the cycle is not yet over. It may be a very pessimistic theory. In fact, you may be another Malthus. We reach a certain point in which a combination of circumstances allow an economic takeoff. Once that happens, you have the beginnings of government expansion, which brings dysgenic effects, which brings the upward swing to a halt. And for the rest of human history, we just bump along at a rather flat level, perhaps.
I agree. That might well be a possibility. And actually, I thought I indicated that I consider this a very real possibility and, of course, a very real danger, so to speak, that we are have reached, so to speak, the peak of the development, and there will be a decline from now on.
So, when you address this question, I was a little bit concerned about your reservations about striving faithfully class and dealing with class and such. A, is that we're not entirely parasitic in some fucking good. And B, they're very, very large. And they are not as coherent or as easily identifiable as ruling classes. That's number one. Most ruling classes are not entirely parasitic. They provide people with decent income. The two remains of England were quite happy to have jobs and performances for people. They were free stays. There were all kinds of things which were probably higher aesthetic and quality, even though some of these people are voters, cerebral capacity, like they process seriously. But they were provided at least the same kinds of funding they. Moreover, the ruling classes in the past had performed some public good. They protected their people against foreign invaders. Remember, these were few vassals of the king who did have some kind of military obligations for which the immediately they were friends. They also needed their food, which finally became available to a large number of people because the aristocracy can't behave there. And so the bourgeoisie. The other point that you made is that you see a small coherent ruling class, everyone believes that. Well, the past is not quite as small as lots of people who were dependent on the ruling class and usually shared their social consciousness. Moreover, if you look at the American media, it is very, very small relative population. You can pick up the New York Times, you see liberal, neoconservative writers, you see what's right every day. You turn on television, you see Bill Crystal, somebody else, and so forth. There is a contingent of 20 people who see on TV and these talk shows and stuff like
agency, a PC by Fox News, a CBS, and so forth. So we're talking about, at least in terms of media, a relatively small number of people who easily identify. Therefore, would you in any way qualify what you said before about how the current ruling class is different from other ruling classes, but in fact, there may be much more noble suggest.
I agree with you that there is a ruling class, but where I disagree is that I'm not quite sure what the common defining characteristic of this thing is. Regarding the benefits of past ruling classes, I think Henry VIII's musical compositions should be seen more as positive externalities. Modern ruling classes do operate consistently within the productive economy in ways that past ruling classes usually didn't. That being said, there may well be certain benefits even to the ruling class that we have at the moment. We spend a lot of time as conservatives and libertarians complaining about the wicked things being done to us by our ruling class, the enemy class, the neoconservatives, the liberals, call them what you will. But these people do not proceed to the outer limits of exploitation. They do leave us with a lot of what we produce, and they don't often take us off and beat us to death in police stations. And so where a Marxist would say, there is the ruling class, brothers, let us rise up and smash it. Let us smash the means of production given to the workers. We do need to bear in mind that just because a ruling class exists and just because it is doing bad things does not mean that we should, on all occasions, seek to overthrow it. We need to consider what would replace it. If we could be reasonably sure that overthrowing a ruling class would lead to a significantly better state of affairs from our own point of view, yes, we should become revolutionaries. If, on the other hand, replacing the existing ruling class would bring us something much worse, then there is an argument for putting up with these people, bad as they are. Now, at the moment, our ruling classes are becoming so awful in what they're doing and in the tendencies that they're setting that I think there is a very good argument for even the most conservative of us to become revolutionary. But again, unlike the Marxists, I think our class theory is, it doesn't have the same declamatory ring about it. Workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose with your chains. We're not even quite sure who the ruling class is.
I had two questions about the ruling class. I think they're related to what you said. The first one is, do you know of any society in history that has not had a ruling class? Because if there hasn't been, then I think we must assume that there is something inherent in nature or a human society that makes a ruling class unavoidable. That's it. My other question is, a parasite socially someone who supports himself and helps provide other people with what they want to use. The people who write and print comic books are not parasites. And this is a fundamental tenet of philosophy and economics. Value is subjective. It can't be measured by some objective piece. It's not what some third party expert says people should want. People make comic books and not parasites because they support themselves by providing other people what they're willing to pay for. And their benefit and independence at providing that is competitive. People who write and act in very few soapboxes are not parasites. They are providing the fire, they earn their living by providing people are willing to watch. And once the advertisements, in addition, it's not up to a third party to say people shouldn't spend money on comic books, people shouldn't spend their time watching. That is totally antithetical to philosophy of the approach. Is it possible that providing an ideology in which people can live is something people want and need? And therefore, they're not parasites. It's a
There are people who get very surprised at the university, don't see that they're wanting something for one. But a third party like you would be, might say people shouldn't want that job. Maybe people just need the job and that's what they want.
Well, what you say touches on what Hans was saying and Richard Lynn, but let me deal with the parasite aspect. I agree that when members of the ruling class operate within the productive economy, they are more or less not parasitic. Those are their productive activities, which is part of what makes the whole analysis so difficult. But coming back to the question, coming back to the point today about how every society has had a ruling class, now that is significant. We can talk about legitimizing ideologies, we can talk about hegemony, discourse theory, false consciousness, and we can use that to explain any one particular ruling class. But every society that has ever existed, every settled society that's ever existed, has had a ruling class. And it may put ordinary people in much the same position as certain bastard wives. You often see these pathetic creatures who've been beaten up by their drunken, disgusting husbands. And there are people who help these women get away from those disgusting men. And then 6 months later, they're in an equally abusive relationship. Now, that may be what the human race is like with regard to ruling classes. You can explain the exploitation of any one class by using all these fancy terms, but the fact that people have always had a ruling class may indicate that... would it be uncharitable to say that most people are stupid?
I want to make a comment. I do not think it is correct to say that every society had a ruling class. Every society... This leads me to make a distinction what the meaning of ruling class is. Every society has, so to speak, rulers. Every society has people who exercise authority. Every society has leaders whose word counts for more than other people's. What we mean by a ruling class, however, is something different from just simply having people who exercise authority. What we mean by ruling class is people who have acquired means in illegitimate ways. People who have established monopolies, people who have stolen the property of other individuals and then draw income from positions that were acquired in an illegitimate way, in a way that involves the infringement of private property rights. So in this sense, of course, it is incorrect to say that a ruling class has existed as long as mankind exists. Rulers have existed as long as mankind exists. Authorities have existed as long as mankind exists. But it is not necessarily the case that these rulers have acquired their means, their property in an illegitimate way. They can have also acquired that in a completely legitimate way and then exercise their authority based on that position.
I have to say, the five people on this, shall we then stop?
No, we will not do five questions. We will do one more question, then I want to say a few final remarks, and then we should retire. One more question.
Asking the last question we had, there's two remarks that I think have first and third one has already been touched. Maybe it's not precise to speak of the ruling classes and to speak only of one class, because this is my big way you can describe in these mixed cases that you were referring to, that you say on Mondays I'm a taxpayer, Tuesdays I'm a tax teacher. So this is not only one person, I think, but it's also through the whole society. The health inspector gets a ticket from the lady in the street for having parked wrongfully. These two persons each explains to the other how to live correctly. So this might be an argument to speak more of one ruling class, but of this. different ruling classes, well, this, this would have maybe departed to not be so, so close to Marxist terminology. So this is part of us testing what you think this might get you out of some difficulty you describe with your theory of consecutives. Are you sure that ruling classes define themselves, or are they maybe defined by the rules themselves? Because the law of laziness has made them delegate some tasks to ruling classes, and the power and the might of ruling classes is simply as the rule that it happened.
I think both your questions come under one heading. What you're asking again is the question that I asked but didn't really satisfactorily answer. Should we talk about a ruling class, or should we talk about a cluster of mutually hostile groups who all to some extent have influence with the state? I think that we can talk about a single ruling class, but there are considerable difficulties, at least in my mind, before I can give a clear view of it.
Well, I think that should end this discussion. I don't want to add anything to it. I agree with what you said. So it is now up to me only to say a few things. First of all, I want to thank you very much that you attended this conference. I hope you enjoyed it. My purpose with this conference is over the years to create the best, the most educational, the most entertaining, the most enlightening, and also the most fun conference that exists anywhere. If there's someone who didn't like the conference, he shouldn't come again. If you did like the conference, please tell your friends about it. So through mouth-to-mouth propaganda, that this will become a more and more exclusive type conference. I do not want to have the conference bigger, but I want to be a conference that everybody clamors to get to. And the final announcement that I want to make is next year the conference will take place again, most likely 1 week later. So at the very end of May, maybe a few days into June. So if you like the conference, please mark your calendar accordingly, and in due time, the exact announcement or the announcement of the exact dates will appear on our website. With that, now let's have fun again. Okay.